Picture a world where the most serious political debates feel like game shows, where news anchors smile through catastrophes, where attention spans shrink by the year. Now, stop imagining. You're living in it. Back in 1985, a media theorist saw this coming with startling clarity. His warning wasn't about censorship or government control. It was about something far more insidious, our willingness to entertain ourselves to death. While George Orwell feared a world where books would be banned, this darker prophecy warned of something worse, a world where nobody would want to read one. The difference matters. We've built defenses against tyranny, but what defense exists against our own appetite for amusement? As we scroll through endless feeds, reducing complex ideas to bite-sized content, perhaps no cultural critique has aged more disturbingly well. Every technology we create secretly remakes us. This isn't about blaming capitalism or lamenting moral decay. It's about understanding how the medium through which we communicate fundamentally shapes what can be communicated at all. Smoke signals can't convey philosophy. A telegraph can't transmit nuance. Television inherently favors the photogenic over the thoughtful. The invention of eyeglasses in the 12th century didn't just help people see better, it planted a revolutionary idea that human limitations aren't final, that we can improve upon nature's design. This conceptual leap connects directly to modern genetic engineering. The microscope revealed invisible worlds, leading thinkers to imagine invisible psychological structures, essentially creating the metaphorical foundation for psychoanalysis. Our tools don't just extend our capabilities, they generate the metaphors through which we understand reality itself. When we shifted from print-based culture to television-dominated society, we didn't just change how we receive information, we changed what counts as information, truth, and knowledge. The medium isn't neutral. It carries built-in biases about what matters and how we should think about it. Early Americans were history's most devoted readers. Between 1640 and 1700, male literacy in Massachusetts reached 89% to 95%, likely the highest concentration anywhere on earth. The poorest laborer felt entitled to express opinions with as much freedom as the gentleman or scholar. This was the direct result of a print-based culture. When Thomas Paine published Common Sense in 1776, it sold 100,000 copies in 2 months, equivalent to 24 million copies today. A dense political pamphlet became a blockbuster. The Lincoln-Douglas debates drew crowds who stood for 7 hours, listening to complex constitutional arguments. No visual aids, no sound bites. Douglas would speak for an hour, Lincoln for 90 minutes. Douglas would rebut for 30 more. And audiences loved it. These audiences weren't superhuman. They were products of a typographic culture that trained minds for sustained attention and logical argumentation. Print demands these things. You can't skim a serious book and understand it. You must slow down, follow intricate reasoning, hold multiple ideas simultaneously. This cognitive training shaped how they thought about everything. The telegraph revolutionized communication by transmitting information faster than people could travel. But this breakthrough shattered context. News flooded in from everywhere. Dramatic, distant, disconnected. A murder in Chicago. A fire in Boston. Each event isolated, unrelated to readers' actual lives. This created the information-action ratio problem. Previously, information had value because you could act on it. News about your town, your trade, your immediate world served a purpose. Telegraphic news offered no such possibility. You learned about distant catastrophes, formed opinions, then nothing. You couldn't respond, help, or change anything. The telegraph also birthed a new language, the headline. Sensational, fragmented, designed to grab attention rather than convey understanding. Knowing transformed, no longer understanding something deeply, but accumulating disconnected facts. Intelligence became knowing of many things rather than knowing about them. The world appeared increasingly unmanageable, a peekaboo world where events appeared and disappeared without explanation or consequence. Photography accelerated this transformation. Unlike language, which constructs arguments through abstractions, photographs deal only in particulars. A photograph cannot make a proposition. It can only testify that something existed. As Susan Sontag observed, photographs suggest we know about the world if we accept it as the camera records it, yet they offer no opinions or conclusions. The mid-19th century witnessed the graphic revolution, a massive invasion of photographs into America's symbolic environment. This wasn't merely supplementing language, but replacing it as our dominant means of understanding reality. Seeing replaced reading as the basis for believing. Photographs provided an illusion of context for telegraphic news, attaching faces to strange names. But this was pseudo-context, a structure invented to give fragmented information seeming purpose, not for action or problem-solving, but for amusement. Crossword puzzles, trivia games, and quiz shows emerged as ways to use disconnected facts for entertainment. This represents the last refuge of a culture overwhelmed by irrelevance. We invented games to make meaninglessness feel meaningful. Television didn't extend print culture. It opposed it. As a fundamentally entertainment-based medium, television made entertainment the natural format for all experience. The problem isn't that it entertains us, but that it conditions us to expect everything to be entertaining: news, politics, religion, education. Consider television news. Stories average 45 seconds, barely enough for basic facts. Producers select attractive anchors whose appearance matters more than analytical skills. Musical themes trivialize content. Commercials interrupt grave news with detergent ads, creating a surrealistic collage that diffuses emotional impact. The phrase, "now, this," between unrelated segments trains us to accept radical discontinuity as normal. This creates a credibility paradox. On television, truth depends not on factual accuracy, but on the presenter's perceived credibility, their appearance, manner, likability. Christine Kraft lost her anchor position not for inaccuracy, but because her looks hampered viewer acceptance. Television transformed politics into show business. Political commercials don't make arguments. They create emotional dramas and evoke feelings. We no longer vote based on party platforms. We vote for personalities reflecting what we wish to see in ourselves. Politicians have become celebrities, appearing on entertainment programs as images of audience aspirations rather than leaders with ideas. Two dystopian visions haunt modern culture: Orwell's 1984, where an authoritarian state controls information, and Huxley's Brave New World, where people willingly surrender critical thinking for amusement. We've prepared to resist Orwellian tyranny. We value free speech, distrust censorship, protect whistleblowers. But Huxley's warning catches us defenseless. In Huxley's world, there's no oppressor, only amusements we've chosen freely. Technology hasn't become our enemy. It's become our ideology, reshaping how we think without our awareness. The path forward isn't abandoning technology. We need media literacy, understanding how different forms of communication shape thought itself. We must teach young people to ask, what forms does information take? What intelligence does each form encourage or discourage? What are the psychic effects? What afflicted people in Brave New World wasn't that they laughed instead of thinking. It was that they didn't know what they were laughing about or why they'd stopped thinking. In a world that packages every experience as entertainment, we've forgotten how to distinguish the trivial from the crucial. The question is whether we'll wake up before we forget there was ever anything to wake up from.